Hello and welcome in to the Sight and Sound Technology Podcast. My name is Stuart Lawler and this is episode number 42. Thank you as always for joining us. Remember, podcast@sightandsound.co.uk is our email address. We love to hear from you with your feedback, comments, suggestions, or indeed, if you'd like to get involved in a podcast and you've got something to say, please get in touch with us. Now, coming up on today's programme, what goes into creating magnifiers for people with sight loss? Henry Green, founder of Occutech, is here with a fascinating interview to tell us all about it. Stay right where you are. That's what's coming up. Vision aids have been around for, well, as long as I can remember and probably a lot longer. And for people who rely on them, they are a key part of their everyday, I was going to say tech arsenal, but just life arsenal. They're the things that they carry around with them, and they come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. Well, I'm delighted today to be joined by Henry Green from Occutech. And Henry is in North Carolina, joins us early in his morning to tell us all about Occutech and the wonderful things they do. Henry, first of all, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. Now, tell us, first of all, We're coming out of, hopefully coming out of a really tough time for society. How have you been doing in North Carolina, you personally and your family? How are you all doing?
Well, fortunately, we, other than not being able to travel, and I used to be getting on airplanes several times a month, if not more, not seeing our grandchildren, staying rather sequestered at home. My wife is a physician at Duke University, so we kind of got the inside track on what's going on in terms of healthcare delivery and the trends in terms of the pandemic, and got early access to the vaccinations, both because of her being in the medical community, but also because one of the few things that benefits you for being an oldster is that you were amongst the first group that were available for access to the vaccines. So we directly have not had any dramatic, you know, family or friend burdens in terms of COVID. Of course, we've had some friends become ill, but everyone has recovered. One or two people have lost smell and taste, but are largely back. There are no seem to be any long haulers amongst our community, fortunately. I think that by and large, we've been all very respectful in social distancing and wearing masks and limiting, you know, being outside in the real world. So that's helped us. Some communities are not as aggressive about being careful, and unfortunately, many of them have paid some price for that.
Sure, sure. Well, good to hear that you are you're safe and well anyway, and you seem to have gotten through it relatively unscathed. But listen, Henry, let's talk a little bit about the history of the company, and maybe first of all, how you got into this area, because it's kind of specialist. What brought you to this journey?
Well, first of all, I am an optometrist. I went to optometry school and graduated in the mid-1970s. So that gives you some idea of what generation I am and how old I am. My interest had always been in doing things that were a little bit exotic and a little bit different than the mainstream. And I always had an interest in dealing with folks with vision issues. To be honest, my goal in life, my career goal in life, was to be a National Geographic photographer. And wow. Growing up, I was spent a lot of time around lenses and cameras and taking pictures. And my father once mentioned to me that how would I feel if I wound up not being successful and being able to just run a portrait studio somewhere rather than being a world traveler taking pictures for National Geographic. And he said, well, you might want to consider that. Maybe you should think of a day job. So I got exposed to optometry, and one of the doctors that I got exposed, got to know, was himself a low vision specialist. His name was George Hellinger in New York City, and I grew up in the New York area. And I spent some time with him out after I graduated from optometry school, learning the specialty of low vision because the training we received in school was not very compelling. But since I already knew my way around optics quite well and now understood vision and perception, I felt that low vision was an area where I could make a contribution, both in terms of clinical care and in terms of innovating new products. And so that's what led me to forming the firm Ocutech, which I started in the mid-1980s. And it evolved to become quite a successful firm developing devices for the visually impaired, specifically for low vision individuals.
Okay, now there are lots of low vision aids out there, right? And obviously, low vision is a very personal thing. No two people will see in the very same way. And it's always very interesting when you have conversations with people about their vision. And I, in particular, maybe Henry, I, as a totally blind person, find it even more interesting sometimes because just to hear the challenges people have and also how they really maximize the vision they have left to use it to its absolute ultimate. But the aids and the solutions, let's say, that you have, which I'm sure have evolved over time since you started the business, go a huge way to helping with that. Can you give us a sense of what goes into the development of some of this technology?
Well, let me give you a little bit of an umbrella overview first. So, we can categorize visual impairment, assuming that there is vision, in terms of either a central vision loss problem from macular degeneration or from diabetic macular edema or from other sorts of optic nerve disorders that affect central vision, which is where our 20/20 or 6/6 or detail high resolution vision is. We can have other sorts of retinal issues that cause tunnel vision and reduction in night vision, such as retinitis pigmentosa and choroideremia. And then we can have issues that impact the optics of the eye, corneal scarring, cataracts, bleeding into the vitreous gel in the back, which cause the vision to be cloudy. So vision could either be a central vision loss or a tunnel vision or a cloudiness, or some combination perhaps of more than one of those things. So depending upon the kind of vision issue that we have, is it will direct what kinds of devices are appropriate to support that issue that they're having. But we also have to categorize and standardize visual activities into kind of overriding groups. And we talk about them in terms of activity distances. Distance seeing, television, recognizing people at a distance, in the classroom, in work, and seeing in distance vision activities such as that. We could have mid-range activities, computer screens, playing music, tabletop activities, arm's length sorts of things. And lastly, it's up close for reading and crafts sorts of activities. And the devices that we use for them will be different depending upon the optical performance of what we're trying to accomplish for that working distance, if you will. So as you say that for certain categories of visual function, such as reading, the options that are available, I think, are quite well known to everyone. We can have much stronger reading glasses. Of course, that requires that we hold the reading material very close to the eye. We can use hand magnifiers with handles or with lights and without lights. There are lots of different ways to make the printed word large enough so that it can be resolved. That doesn't mean you're going to go ahead and sit down and enjoy a long novel. If you're significant visual impairment, then you will read much more likely for need than for pleasure. And in this day and age, with such technology, there's all sorts of ways to access the printed word other than doing it yourself. So we're very fortunate at this time in technology to have such wonderful optical character recording devices and text-to-speech, all sorts of ways to access printed material. But now, being a grandparent, if I were visually impaired, no one can see my grandchildren for me, see the twinkle in their eyes or their smile or see the beauty in the world around me and go to a museum and look at art on the wall. It can be described, but it's not the same experience. So while there were a range of sort of different things we could offer our patients for reading and near-point magnification, there was a dearth of equipment that was available to see better at a distance. And my experience clinically taking care of patients was that if I could do something that helped them see at distance, I got a much more robust emotional response to that sort of activity of help than I got when I helped somebody to read. I used to say that what we try to do when we prescribe low vision aids is to have the patient pass the O test. And we spell the O test OH. So if I do something for a patient and they go, oh, then that's passing the O test. And that's getting the emotional response that I'm looking for that makes me feel more confident that this is going to be something that will be impactful. We directed all of our interest in Ocutech in developing devices that would be easier to prescribe and more acceptable for distance seeing for the visually impaired.
And I imagine that, just going back to that O test there for a sec, I imagine that this is a business. Yes, you're obviously you have to make money. You're a commercial company, but it's a business you're in because you want to work with people as well. You want to improve somebody's quality of life, and it must be very gratifying when that happens.
Our products have changed people's lives, and we hear that from our patients who communicate with us all the time. And I can't imagine anything more rewarding than being able to favorably impact someone's life. And that's a large part of the motivation for continuing to do this work.
Now, I want to ask you, and we talked about this very briefly before we came on air, but I want to talk a little bit about, I suppose, how these things look and aesthetics, I suppose we call it. So when people are choosing a device, and yes, of course, they're going to, I'm sure, sit with you and look at the device and how well they can see with it. But I'm sure a big part of the consideration as well must be, how does this thing look on me? Because they want to look cool or whatever it is. Do you put a lot of time into how this technology is going to look in the real world and how it will be perceived by society?
Well, when the Google Glass came out a number of years ago, all of us in the low vision field were very excited because if it was well accepted, then it would start to be normal for people to have gadgets attached to their eyeglasses. And then folks who had low vision who were wearing similar sorts of devices would no lo longer look unusual. Of course, it didn't go over as well as Google might have hoped for. But nevertheless, you're exactly right. No one wants to be made to look unusual. People who wear hearing aids, perhaps, which are very much less visible than the devices we make on eyeglasses, are also kind of self-conscious about wearing something like that because it explains a bit of a disability. But I think that individuals tend to be much more self-conscious about these things than are their companions. And the people they may meet, their companions may say, "What is that? Tell me all about it." And then invariably they will say, "Oh, gee, that's cool. Can I try it even?" So we do spend an awful lot of time trying to make these things look as appealing and high tech as possible. So there's a process for doing that. First, everything is based upon the quality optics that are inside. And once we've got the optics finalized, so we're happy with that performance, then we have to, in effect, wrap the device and design an appearance for it that accomplishes a couple of things. Makes it easy for the doctor to prescribe it. And there is a fair amount of angst by doctors who are not comfortable prescribing these things, worried that they might make a mistake. And what do you do if it has to be redone? So a large part of the mechanical design of our products is to take all the risk and hassle out of demonstrating and prescribing our devices because they have mechanical mountings, they're very easy to reposition, and it's virtually foolproof. So there's a saying in design, which I've learned from the engineers that we consult with, that is that if you can't hide it, you have to celebrate it. So one way to celebrate is to make the case look sexy, make it look high tech, and the other is to perhaps have it in colors. And what prompted that is I had a young lady come in who needed a telescope for school, and she had albinism, and her favorite color was pink. And she said, "Well, if you make it in pink," and at that point the only color we had was black, "if you said if you make it in pink, then I'll wear it." So I called up architect, because at that point I was in my office, and I said, "Can you make us a pink one?" And they said, "Give us a couple of weeks." So in a couple of weeks they had a pink one, and she loved it. Matter of fact, she took some of these self-adhesive little jewel things you can paste on things and blinged up her telescope and made it look like jewelry. So it dawned on us that one of the things that we could do to make these more fun, if you will, to celebrate them more, is to have colors. But we didn't know quite what colors to offer. So we thought we would hold a focus group and bring in a bunch of folks who might be patients for these or who already wore our equipment and explore these sorts of issues. And my youngest son, who's a computer science guy, said, No, don't spend your time and effort and cost doing that. Just go on the Apple website and see what colors they make their products, because they've done all the research already." So we listened to
So
my
true.
very smart son,
Yeah, he was
and
right.
we copied their colors, and he was exactly right. And
Okay.
so that's part of what we do. We try to make them look as high tech and as professional looking as possible.
I was looking on your website. There's a huge amount of stuff you have. There's sport ranges. There's all sorts of different type of magnification aids. I'm kind of guessing you must have a lot of returning customers, people who maybe come back to you as their vision has changed because they need maybe a device to do something slightly different to how it might have been prescribed originally.
I'm not honestly terribly aware, Stuart, that we get many individuals who kind of trade up, if you will, to a different product, unless they switch from a manual focus product to our new autofocusing product, which we're quite proud of and addresses some major concerns that all manual focusing or fixed focus telescopes have, and allow us to do things that let an individual do things much more naturally than they might otherwise be able to do. But the range of products has to do with powers. So the more the poorer the visual acuity of the individual, the greater the magnification needs to be to get them the level of visual acuity they need to perform their goal. So if their vision were to become reduced, then there were other options for higher power versions of the same product. We do know that when powers get higher than 6x, it's much less likely that these will be effective for individuals. So our products stop at the 6x range. Our most frequently prescribed products are between 2 and 4x.
Can you talk to us a little then about this new technology? And we mentioned it already that the ability to be able to auto focus and maybe
Sure.
how that works and what the benefits would be for those people who would use it.
Normally, for normally sighted individuals, we all have autofocus eyes. Wherever we look, it's going to be clear right away. And even when we get to be over 45 and we start needing bifocals, if we wear bifocals, it's just easy to switch our attention from one part of the eyeglass lens to another, and it's clear right away. When you look through a telescope that's misfocused, you can't see anything. And for all those of us who are camera buffs like me, if you're using a telephoto lens, the depth of focus is very shallow. So when you look from one distance to another, you have to focus all the time. And when you look at close distances, the depth of field is very shallow. So either you have to be constantly changing focus of the device, even if you move in or out just an inch or two, or you have to hold a very steady posture, which is fatiguing. So the goal in developing any kind of device is to make it as close to normal for the individual to use, as close to natural as possible. So if you have an autofocusing device, wherever you look, it's clear virtually immediately. So just like natural vision. So you can look at the teacher in the classroom, look at the blackboard, look at a classmate, look at your tabletop or your desk or a computer screen, and they're virtually clear right away. So you no longer have to be involved in manipulating the device. All you have to do is look, just like natural vision. And so that's what the Falcon Autofocus product enables us to provide. So if we have individuals who only want to look at one distance or for, far away perhaps, then an autofocusing device may not be necessarily appropriate. But for most of us, we're constantly looking at different distances. And the more natural we make the use of the device, the more convenient it is to integrate into your life and the more successful you'll be with it. And again, it's designed in a way to make it look very high tech and appealing, very easy for the prescriber to demonstrate and prescribe. And it only weighs about 90 grams. So while it does get heavy after a number of hours, we know we have patients who wear them many hours during the day. And so we have individuals who want to play piano or look at a computer and have their hands free and yet still be able to see the music clearly. And the Falcon is able to really support those sorts of functional needs. So that's quite rewarding that this new product has been so well received.
Now, just if we can talk very broadly around price points, because I know there is lots and lots of stuff, but what sort of typically give us just some ideas of some of the popular sets maybe and the rough costs.
Well, Ocutech does not sell directly to the patient. We go through doctors, and the doctors will set the final price to their patient. And the reason we have that model is because we think it's so important for someone with low vision to visit a low vision specialist. If you go directly to a company who's interested in sales, their relationship and their motivation is to sell their product, which is certainly understandable. And their salespeople, I don't doubt, are devoted and committed to taking appropriate care of the patient. But they've only got that one product or range of products that they're promoting. And once a sale is made, there's really no long-term relationship with them anymore. So if you go to a low vision specialist, there is a long-term relationship, and they're committed and devoted to providing the appropriate device or devices for the individual's needs. And so the price that they're going to charge the individual is a combination of the cost of the product, of course, plus the professional time involved in the assessment and training them to use it and supervising their adaptation. So in the US, and that's really where I have to, base my
Yeah, sure.
response,
Yeah.
manual focus devices are under comfortably under $2,000, lock, stock, and barrel, and sometimes less depending upon the fee structure of the clinic where they're being provided. The Falcon is in the $3,000 range. I'm pleased to say that we have spent a lot of time developing clinical protocols for training doctors in how to assess a patient and establish an appropriate prognosis. And our return rate, or what's called the non-adapt rate, believe it or not, is less than 0.1%. We rarely get one of our products back because a patient decides that it's not helpful for them. But we get products back virtually every day to be cleaned and readjusted and refurbished. Some of them have been really beat up. And it's thrilling for us to see that because that doesn't happen if they're not being used. And so that's the bottom line for us, that they are being used. And if someone's patient's prescription were to change, they have to have the eyeglass lenses updated for a new prescription, they wouldn't be spending the money on refurbishing them or updating them if they weren't valuable to them. So we have to differentiate between cost and value in terms of these products that are perceived to be much more expensive than a conventional pair of eyeglasses. The problem, of course, is that these are all sort of orphan drugs. They cost more because the volume is not high.
Can I ask you maybe as well to just you made reference earlier onto the Google Glass, and there's been some interesting stuff done in the kind of wearable tech research lately. Apple are supposedly going to come out with something, I think, in the not too distant future. What direction is it going, do you think? Where do you see, what do you think are the big things we should be looking at in the future?
Well, there's a limit to what conventional analog optics, which is what we use now in our products, can do. All we can do is make an image larger, make the quality of the resolution sharper, to a certain degree, increase the field of view. But they don't work well in very low illumination, and you can't enhance the quality of the image the way you can with digital displays. And we have spent a fair amount of time and an awful lot of money exploring and prototyping electronic products for this market. And you can't create your own technology. You have to piggyback on existing technology because otherwise it's just cost prohibitive. So we have to piggyback on head-mounted displays or the new version of the Google Glass. And the problem with all of this technology is it's not designed for low vision individuals. They're designed for tech people, for gamers, for other sorts of applications. So we have to adapt them for our purposes. And the problem with the displays, the digital displays that are available now, is that they're not terribly bright. In the same way, if we take our cell phone outside in the sun, you can't see the screen. And so that's why they have to cowl you in so that you can get rid of the ambient illumination from the sun outside so you can see the screen, which makes it very inconvenient and not functional for the sorts of applications that a low vision individual might care to pursue. Now, if they only want to wear it inside and illumination and environment is much more controlled, certainly for individuals with very reduced vision, there's been some promising success with these head-mounted displays. But their resolution is not nearly as high as that with optical devices. So we have to wait for the technology to get better so we can really make these devices compelling. But it's only a matter of time, in my opinion, for that to happen. One of the problems that we had developing the Falcon was that technology changes pretty promptly. And if you're working on developing a new product and working with certain technological components, integrated circuits, and certain kinds of actuators, by the time you've got it all figured out, you can't get that one anymore. You order some from a company, and then they say, "We reserve the right to discontinue at any time without notice." So, how can you create a business plan based upon the lack of access for that? And I'll tell you a cute story if you're interested. The Falcon is our newest version of the autofocus. The original one we did in the 1990s. We needed a very small, lightweight motor to move the focus, and we came across a little, it's called stepper motor. That they were using in computer hard disks. And the manufacturer said that the minimum order of these was 10,000 units. And they wanted over $100 each. And so that would just break the bank. And that was the end of that project. But we found that we could buy the little disk drives that are made for computers that have that same motor in there. We bought the disk drive for $40 or $50 and took the motor out and used it for our autofocus product and threw away the rest. Eventually we could get them directly and not spend so much money. But these are the sorts of challenges that innovators in product development have to face. In terms of creating something specifically for our patients.
Henry, it's been really, really interesting to chat to you and to get some understanding of not only the products and what they do, but of the work you're doing to make them better all the time. And I suppose, in particular, how you are giving life back to people with low vision, where things can be very, very challenging, I think, for people. Could you give us the could you give us your website where people can maybe go and if they want to find out more information about the huge range of products you have?
Yes, the company is Ocutech, Ocutech, and the website is ocutech.com. I also welcome in your listeners if they want to reach out to me directly. My email is HG, my initials, at Occutech.com, and I get inquiries from patients and doctors very frequently, and I'm happy to respond. I might also add that not only does our website have information about our products, but a lot of general information for individuals who have a visual impairment about how all of this works, and we certainly welcome them to visit and learn more about this entire field.
Okay, it's a great website. I was having a look at it last night. Very, very good. Henry, thanks very much for chatting to us. Great to talk to you. Stay safe and well, and hope we get to catch up soon. But in the meantime, thanks a million.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much, Stuart.
Thank you very much, Henry. Thoroughly enjoyed that piece. And it's really interesting, isn't it? When you think about people who use these magnifiers, they are life-changing, and the technology behind them, the potential future technology and how that might be used, it's just really interesting to think about how these devices are going to continue to make a significant impact for people with low vision. Now, that's just about it for this edition of the podcast, but we're back soon. Until then, from Stuart Lawler and everybody at Sight & Sound, stay safe and stay well, and thank you for listening. Thank you.